So I had something happen, was it last week, which kind of rolled over into this week.
Yeah.
Put me a nice little tunnel over my English peas to save them during that cold spell, and it worked wonderfully. You know, it wasn't a Taj Mahal by any means, but it looked pretty decent for the time it took me to put it together. And I shot a video when I did it, and I was kind of in a hurry, and I went back, looked at the footage, and it was all out of focus. The wind was blowing. We do got a little bit there we're going to be able to use a little bit, but I'm going to have to kind of go back and shoot it in reverse. So I'd planned to show everybody that this week, and that's one of the reasons why we didn't have any videos this week. A lot going on. We were out of town. A lot of catching up we got to do. We're going to get back on the ball next week, but we didn't. This is our only video this week, and we lost some footage there, which happens from time to time. And but just so you know, we want to put out three videos a week all the time. It doesn't always work that way. But speaking of the English peas, I want to show you some here. So I got some right here. Now, this is the Mr. Big, which is never grown before. But these make some big old pots. Now, some of these ain't filled out yet, but I just wanted to bring them to show you what they look like size-wise. That's a big old English pea right there.
That is. That's one of the biggest ones I've ever seen. And this one looks like it could probably fill out just a little bit more.
I figured we'd give them a little taste test. These things good to eat raw. Yeah. So that one right here is pretty good.
Pretty close.
You could you could eat them all day.
Boy, he's sweet. I've never planted Mr. Big before.
They just now starting to come in. And I got that hoop set up on them, which I'll show you everybody on the video. And if I can keep these things from getting bit, come late February, March, you talking about starting to make some peas. We'll definitely have it. But so I've been happy with this variety so far. And it is definitely the biggest English pea variety I have ever seen. That one there's got probably 10 peas in it. So good size on that.
Well, speaking of boo-boos, what about this egg and hole thing?
I was going to mention that. So last week on the show, and if you didn't see it, you can go back and watch it.
We was midstream talking about gardening, and Travis wants to start talking about breakfast foods all of a sudden. Kind of caught me off guard, but I said egg and hole, so I went with it.
Well, we had somebody ask a question about tomatoes, and I did think it was kind of weird that they asked a question about tomatoes and then about an egg in the hole, but I never put two and two together and stuff until I started answering and reading the comments on last
week's
show.
And we had a lot of people comment to us how wrong we were.
Yeah, they were talking about somebody putting an actual egg in the hole beside their tomato.
Well, that's something I've never heard of before. Now, we've eaten egg in holes, and we covered that. If you did not familiar with it, we covered that last week. But I've never heard of nobody putting an egg in the hole planting tomatoes.
I haven't either. Now, I've seen a couple of videos out there of people put a fish in the hole. And I've got this list of videos to do in the future, and one of mine this spring is I'm gonna do a video about the fish.
Well, why
in the hole.
Would you want to put an egg in the hole when you're planting? But no,
they think it's gonna add calcium at some point. But I got news for you out there, and I don't care who the source was that did this video or told you that. If you bury an egg or a fish beside a tomato plant, you ain't did nothing but bury a fish or egg.
How long does it take an eggshell to break down on average?
Longer than that tomato plant's going to be there.
I have the answer for that.
Go for it.
3 years.
Before any
calcium's released, so that your tomato plant is well gone after that. Now, if you too tight to buy some type of calcium to put on your tomatoes to prevent blossom end rot, and you want to feel like you've done something, go get you a scrap piece of sheetrock, which is gypsum. Just get you some wherever you have to get that. Get you some scrap pieces of gypsum, and cut you some 3x3 squares or rectangles, or whatever, and put that in the hole, and you'll be done something. That's a decent calcium source. If you're that hard up to get a calcium source,
trying to be real frugal with your tomatoes,
but don't do the egg in the hole. Save yourself an egg and save yourself some troubles.
And a fish.
Don't. You ain't done nothing. Now you may feel good about it, but then the day you got a buried egg in the hole.
And what you got to realize, some of these YouTubers out here that did this, they do these videos so people will click on it, because some people actually believe stuff like this works. Yep. But it's going to take a lot longer for that. If I buried a fish beside a tomato plant, all I'm doing is giving something for my cats to dig up or dogs or whatever. Yeah. We've talked about this before with organic versus inorganic fertilizer. All organic sources have to be broken down to inorganic forms. Now, if you're totally against inorganic fertilizer and that's your stance, I don't have a problem with that. But that organic fertilizer has to be broken down to tiny little inorganic forms so it can be absorbed by the cell wall. So if you put big organic material there, it's just not going to break down quick enough.
And that's the reason 90% of the time organic fertilizers work better in warm soils than they do cool soils.
Yeah.
The exception of that is Chelate nitrate. But every other that I can think of, every other organic fertilizer besides Chelate nitrate breaks down and works a lot quicker in warmer soils because the microbes are there to help break it down. Your bone meals, your feather meals, any of that work better in fish emulsion. Any of those work a lot better than warm soils.
I've seen some YouTubers that go out there this time of year and put bone meal and stuff in the garden, and it just ain't.
It's too slow of a process.
Now, it might take into effect come spring because it ain't going to go anywhere.
Or summer.
Yeah. But it ain't going to hit them.
No.
This time of year.
Nope.
All right, what else we got going on? Did you bring something to snack on or something to eat?
Well, I got a couple things. Let's go over this to start with. So last night, I made me a batch of sauerkraut.
Okay.
Now, this here ferment, I'm kind of new to it, but I like it. I may do me more of this. It was really fun. I made me some, this is my first shot at it, so don't judge me too hard, but I made me 3 jars of sauerkraut, and there's a lot of cabbage in there.
So this is one of our fermenting kits.
Yes.
Some of the stuff we carry, the mason top pipe. You got the weight in there.
I do. I didn't buy the kit. I went back and cherry picked what I wanted, but you buy the kit and you got everything you need to do it in there. It's a simple process. It's just cabbage and salt.
And was it water or vinegar in there?
No. Let me expand on that.
Go for it.
So you put the salt in there, and the salt breaks down the cabbage and releases the water. So I didn't add any water to this here.
Okay, just sweats, basically.
It sweats, basically. Now, here's the issue, and I watched a YouTube guy do this beforehand, and he gave a fair warning. If you're going to do this right here, you want to weigh your cabbage after you got it shredded, and you want to put 2% of kosher salt to that. It's real easy to get out of balance. And the best thing to do, and I'm horrible at this, the best thing to do is to weigh it and get it right. You want 2% salt to your cabbage. And for you folks for you folks in Alabama, if you got 100 ounces of cabbage, then you want 2 ounces of salt in there.
Make 100 grams. I doubt you got 100
ounces. No, I was just trying to explain them what
100 grams.
2% meant.
Yeah, you're right,
I think most people gets it, but them folks over there.
That went to school at Tuscaloosa. They might need a little.
They may need a little pushing along there. So I would highly recommend weighing it out. I didn't do that, and I may have got my salt a little too heavy because you know how us men is. We don't want to weigh nothing.
Right.
If I do it again, I'm definitely going to weigh it out. Simple. It takes you a little while to cut it up because I like to cut mine fine. Simple, fun to do. Cut it up, put it in there, mash it down good. That salt will break it down. I didn't spend an hour, probably 45 minutes at the most. The wife probably spent a good 30 minutes cleaning up behind me.
Right.
But that was it. So
that's going to make some. Once that gets ready, we'll have to have some hot dogs on the show.
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
We'll have hot dogs in 2 weeks.
So let's move on. Let's talk about cabbage a minute, because certain people have been known to do some bragging about their cabbage here lately.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to show these right here. And that's
did decide to bring that on the day where I didn't bring a cabbage, so you wouldn't be shamed too much.
Well, no, I'm going to add to this. So this is the Jersey Wakefield, right?
Yeah, the conical
shape. We call them conehead cabbage. Now, I've grown this one for a long time, and this is a Cheers variety. Now, these two cabbages was grown in the same row, and they got the same amount of water, fertilizer, and everything.
Mm-hmm.
This being an heirloom variety made a smaller head than the Cheers did. So if you're growing strictly by weight, I would recommend growing the Cheers variety over the Jersey Wakefield. Although, it being an heirloom, it may have a different flavor profile. I haven't tested them yet and see. There you have it. Mm-hmm. This is the point I want to get to. A lot of people, when they show their cabbage, they want to leave all them big leaves on them, so they look bigger and they hold them back like this right here. Well, I went ahead and peeled mine back where I could show you actually what we had here. Now, what I have accomplished here is I have grown some personal size cabbage. I wasn't trying to grow no big gaudy cabbage like some people are trying to do. Your mom and I can't eat 5 gallons of coleslaw at one time. We don't need that much. So I wanted to grow enough cabbage so we can make us a nice meal off of it and be done. Some people want to grow enough where they can have a 5 gallon bucket full of coleslaw or whatever. I was not trying to do that. And I accomplished growing these personal sized cabbage.
That's a great way to spend.
Sure it
is. A positive aspect on your weenie cabbage.
Well, I mean, it's pretty. That's a decent sized cabbage, but that's, I would want them that size or smaller. I wouldn't want anything bigger
than
that.
Says the man who didn't grow me.
Yeah, and that right there, that's a nice size right there for two people. That's perfect.
Yeah, no, there's nothing wrong with those.
Yeah, but anyhow, that's what I have done, and I want to share it with everybody and kind of give you a little different spin on some things that other people have been trying to bring out with them big old cabbage that they got, and they got them, they didn't dress them down, and they got them big old leaves on them and everything. This is really what mine looks like after you get it nailed down, and that's about ready to eat right there, and that's perfect. The takeaway, the Cheers cabbage is a good variety.
It's a winner.
It's a winner. I love this variety right here. And if you're into growing heirlooms, there ain't nothing wrong with that cabbage right there. But if you, for pound, that Cheers will outperform it.
All right. Glad you feel good about your cabbage, whatever you got to do to deal with the
personal size.
Personal size.
Yeah.
Let's see what else we got going on. I wanted to show this real quick. A couple weeks ago, we talked about seed starting, and actually on the show, we demonstrated seed starting, and I did
some. I think we planted that trail.
We planted this trail on the show. Now, I didn't take care of this at all, so I watered it maybe once or twice and just set it in the office there. I just wanted to show you. We talked about on that show boo-boos and what not to do. This is what happens if you set it on a table with fluorescent lights on the ceiling. They get way too leggy. And see, if this plant was this size, you should be able to pull on that and pull it out of there. But you can see everything's kind of falling apart.
Half that size right there, we'd be willing and ready to transplant that.
Right. Baby. So this is what happens. They climb too tall towards the light. They get leggy. And that's why if you don't grow them outside or in a greenhouse, you want to keep that light right on top of them so they're not stretching. And then when they do get this size, they've got enough root structure and your stem is bigger. So when you put these outside, they'll do a lot better.
Yeah, let's talk just a little bit about my ghost pepper experiment here. You know, we got some ghost pepper seed in. A lot of you folks have ordered them. And I held me back 50 seeds, and I've got mine in the freezer, what we call stratification. I'm stratifying these seeds. Now, if you've got some of these ghost pepper seeds and you want to try them, I'd recommend that you do that. And what you do by putting them in the freezer, when you take them directly out of the freezer, you want to plant them in your seed starting tray. And that extreme to another extreme helps that ghost pepper seed germinate a lot better and quicker. So I'm going to let mine sit in there a couple of weeks, maybe not that long. Oh, this time, I got maybe a few more days.
So the transition from the cold fridge to what we'll have them on a heat mat is going to trigger the germination better.
Yes, it kind of tricks the seed a little bit, thinking it's coming out of an Arctic cold to a warm thing.
Yeah.
Get out there. It does help because these ghost peppers are known to be a little bit slow in the germination. So if you're going to try that, definitely stratify your seed, and I think you'll like that. I've done it before with pepper seeds and tomato seeds and other things, but these hot pepper seeds, it's more important than you can get by with some of your tomato seeds.
I brought something else to brag on here. And this is I don't grow personal size cabbage, and I don't really care for growing personal size lettuce either. So I got two here. Now, I'm thinking I may have grown, or we may have grown this Cherokee way back in the day one year at the Expo Demo Garden. I can't remember. It had been a while since I've grown it, and I have been really pleased it's obviously heat tolerant, a nice lettuce to grow. But the weight and density of these heads there's a lot here. So I wanted you to, obviously we can't do this on, nobody in the audience is going to be able to tell, but you would think this, just by looking at it, that this guy here, this Harmony Butterhead, would weigh a good bit more than this. I'll let you feel them both and you can kind of tell.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of weight difference there. Yeah. So that's a lot heavier.
So that Cherokee there, it's kind of really tight. Of course, this one isn't all the way there. It's working on tightening itself up. But man, you get a lot. There's a lot of lettuce inside that head right there.
You know, we were just speaking about inorganic and organic fertilizer. These lettuces, for some reason or another, respond a lot better to organic fertilizers than they do inorganic fertilizers. Probably the best recipe, if you don't mind, is doing some of both. But these lettuces and everything really like organic matter in the soils.
Yeah, yeah. They like that chicken manure peanut holes I tilled in beforehand. Mm-hmm. So these are just getting there. So I got a little bit of leaf burn on these butterheads, but nothing wrong with either of those.
Yeah, they all right.
Just all right.
They all right.
All right. And what else we got? A lot of people have been asking about taters. Taters are supposed to be on a reefer truck. That's a refrigerated truck for you, not in the truck driving industry.
Yeah, this weekend. So we expect to have them next week. Now, I can't tell you what day, but I'd be promised we'd have them next week. We're hoping toward Tuesday, Wednesday, and it'll take us a day or two to get our thoughts together after we get them in and get some packed up and start getting them out maybe toward the end of next week.
Yeah, we got thousands and thousands of pounds of taters to get out, and we'll start getting them out as quick as we can. And if we have them here before we do next week's show, we'll talk about our tater varieties. If not, it'll be the following show. But one of the next two shows, we'll go in detail on each of the varieties and show you what they look like. Speaking of varieties, got a bunch of new stuff we've been adding these last few days, and I want to go over some of it. First things first is our Cherokee Tan pumpkin here. And if you subscribe to our email newsletter, which if you haven't, you can go to the bottom of our webpage, click the button there and do that. Or if you're a member of our Row by Row group on Facebook, you already know that we've got these available now.
We got some left.
As of around the end of this video, I looked and we got about 180 left. So we actually had about, I don't know, 350 to 400, and they sold like hotcakes on Friday when we let them, kind of turned them loose. There's 10 seeds per packet here, but I promise you that's all any fella needs unless you want to grow a couple acres of them.
If you know of a pumpkin that has more vigor, more disease resistance, and more insect resistance than this variety here, old Hoss here would sure like to know about it, because that's the beatenest thing I've ever seen right there.
Like you told one fellow on the Road by Road group, just plant them and stand back.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Just, you know, we planted one row on drip tape.
15 seeds, I believe, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was 15 seeds.
You'll get about, from our experiences, 10 to 15 pumpkins per plant, and the plants will just grow and grow and grow and grow. So get your hands on some of these if you want them. It's kind of exclusive to us. I know Danny at Deep South Homestead sells a few, but exclusive to us here. Check those out. There's Cherokee Tans. A few more things people have been asking about. The Savannah mustard, which you may have seen us try on the show last week. We ate some. Also saw me do a video where I was showing cutting some of this. We had it in the quarter pounds. We now have it in the packets of 500 seeds. You can plant this right now pretty much no matter where you live. Plant you some of this right now makes a great early spring crop. The fastest growing green you will find right here.
This is a spinach type mustard that has a very smooth flavor to them.
What else we got here? The sunburst squash, which is this yellow patty pan, which is probably one of our most popular summer squash varieties, was out of stock for a little while. We got it restocked. It's ready to go. We got plenty of it. And people have been waiting on that. Get that. Collards. We mentioned a few shows ago that the tiger collard was being phased out, replaced with the top bunch 2.0. We still have some tiger. When they're gone, they're gone. We still have some of those. I've got some of these starting in the greenhouse right now that I'm going to plant in early spring. So I got the top bunch 2.0. And then beans and corn. So I'll let you hold one of these. Or I can hold both of them. So two new varieties of green beans that we got. I'm really excited about this Momentum bush bean, which you won't find. I'm pretty sure we're the only ones out there carrying it. Momentum, we grew that several years ago. I know I did. It's a bush bean, and it is the most productive bush bean I've ever seen. It is.
It is one of those English type beans. It's long.
No, it's your standard cannon size. But if you want one that's going to really blow your mind, the Momentum is the way to go. And then we've got this Kentucky Blue Pole Bean, which is actually an AAS winner. And it is a hybrid mix between your Blue Lake bush bean and your Kentucky Wonder pole bean. And it's supposed to be an improved pole bean variety. And I'm going to grow me some of these too. So the Kentucky Blue Pole Bean, the Momentum bush bean.
Let me talk about PC in a minute.
Hold on, I got two more corns.
Hurry up. I got to get this PC thing out of here.
And then the Triple Sweet Corns, we just added two more of these. Both of these are bicolor. We've got Providence and Primus, just like that Honey Select that was so good. These Triple Sweet Corns. I haven't decided which one of these I'm going to grow, but I'm going to grow one of these right here. That Triple Sweet Corn is something else to eat.
Don't care for it. All right, so let me tell you all about pea seed. Pea seed, we're going to have in the next 2 weeks, I hope. Here's the thing. I don't know why this is, but they never send out pea seeds the following year's seeds to somewhere to January and February. So don't get in a hurry and order your pea seeds in the fall of the year, because what you're going to be doing is buying last year's seed. We're getting a whole big fresh batch of seeds in because what we sold out last year and we don't have any.
Right.
So we're getting them all in and they come in a couple weeks. Bear with us. Just wait till you get these new seeds in before you plant, before you order. You don't want to be ordering from some of these other companies that's got 2 to 3 year old seeds. And if they got them in stock in the fall of the year, it ain't the last year's, the year before at least crop. So bear with us a couple weeks. As soon as we get them in, we'll get them on the site, and then you'll be buying fresh seeds. And we got several new varieties on that, but we're going to talk about that a little bit more when we get in. I just want to warn everybody, don't jump the gun on your southern pea seed yet.
Good idea. All right, so today's show, what we're going to be talking about is something that we get asked a lot, and crop specific, is what should I transplant? What should I direct seed? What do I need to start in the greenhouse? What do I need to just direct seed? And some of these are obvious, and some of them aren't as obvious. Some of them can go both ways.
Some work better for other people than others. So this ain't etched in stone.
So we're just going to give you an idea of what we do, and I'll tell you, this is wet right here, going to mess up my papers. Give you an idea of what we do, why we transplant or why we direct seed some of these and go through them, and we'll just bump through them. Some of these, it's always we do one or the other. Some of them, there's an asterisk, and we'll discuss that. So let's start off with the stuff that we like to transplant, okay? So transplant crops. Let's start off, and these are kind of in alphabetical order. First one, beets. I like transplanting beets. You don't have to transplant beets. You can direct seed beets, especially if you're growing a monogerm variety like Solo, or if you're growing a multi-germ variety, Kestrel, Early Top, any of those. To get consistently sized beets, they will need to be thinned. I prefer to thin them standing up in the greenhouse versus thinning them on my knees in the field. That's why I grow them for transplants. Beets can also have a little finicky germination. So I like transplanting them. It's a little more work, but that's what I do. Plenty of people direct seed them with success.
I've had good luck with transplanting beets.
Broccoli, we always transplant broccoli. Brussels sprouts, we always transplant that.
Man, if they want that, or you want to transplant Brussels sprouts, because that gives you a head start, and this thing's take you forever.
Cabbage, we always transplant cabbage. Cantaloupes, you can direct seed, but you can also transplant them. If you live in a climate where your warm growing season isn't as long as, say, maybe ours is, transplanting your cantaloupes is going to be the way to go. And we'll talk about some of the advantages to transplanting and direct seeding in a little bit. But you can do both with cantaloupe. I would recommend transplanting if you can. Cauliflower, we always want to transplant. Collards. Now, collards is going to depend, in my opinion, what variety of collards you're growing. Now, if you're just going to grow some, or say this, if this is how you like to plant collards, and we know plenty of people like to do this, they like to till them up a spot and just go out there and scatter, almost like a cover crop, scatter collard seeds, let them come up, and then go single cut them. If you're going to do that, make sure you get one of those cheap collard varieties like Vates or something like that. You don't want to buy top bunch collards and go out there and direct seed them and strow them. If you're doing a higher end, higher price collard, more improved variety, you want to transplant them.
Yep.
You get more bang for your buck from your seed. Eggplant, of course, we transplant those. Gourds, and we'll see this with pumpkins too. You can direct seed or transplant those.
Yeah, I kind of disagree with you on that one. I direct seed my gourds.
Just up to you.
It's okay, ain't it?
Yeah, that's okay. That's why I got the star there. You can do. You can do.
The reason I say that is they're normally cheap seeds, and they normally come up pretty well. And it's not what we'll call a high value crop.
Right.
So I don't know that I'd waste greenhouse space on a gourd.
Okay. Kale, you can do both, depending on what you're wanting to do. If you're wanting to do like we did with the dinosaur kale, space it out 1 foot on the drip tape and keep cropping it over and over and over, transplant it. If you want to grow it real dense on a bed, like maybe some red Russian or something, and do cut and come again,
yeah,
you would direct seed it. So it just depends on how densely you want to plant it. Kohlrabi, we always transplant kohlrabi. Let's go to our second page of transplants here. Leeks. Leeks, just like onions, you always want to transplant those. They're slow to come up. If you try to direct seed them, your weeds are going to overtake them and have trouble. Lettuce, if you're growing head lettuce, and I got a video coming soon on this, if you're growing head lettuce, transplant it. If you're growing leaf lettuce that you're going to cut and come again, you're going to plant real thick, you direct seed it. Okra.
Used to be one I was dead set against. I always direct seed them okra, but we've been doing transplant last few years. Okra does not like cool soils. So this gives you the opportunity to get those transplants up when it's maybe a little bit cooler and it'll give you 3 to 4 weeks head start on everybody else if they direct seed them. So okra in a greenhouse transplant, we've been transplanting about 3 years now, works fine.
Yeah. So in early spring, we'll transplant. Once it gets hot, our second or third round, we'll direct seed them, but they do work really good as transplants. Onions, of course, we always want to transplant onions, with the exception of those kind of bunching onions you showed. Peppers, we'll transplant those. Pumpkins, it's kind of like the gourd thing. Just depends. If it's a fairly easy to get cheap pumpkin seed, OP, you know, direct seed them, not going to hurt anything, and thin them out. If in our case, like we did with the Cherokee Tans last year.
Or those big old giant pumpkins I planted a few years ago, those seeds were expensive and rare and hard to get. So, I grew those in the greenhouse.
Right.
The value of the crop will dictate a lot of whether you want to direct seed it or transplant it.
Rutabagas, a lot of people have been direct seeding rutabagas their whole life and doing fine. I have recently found really good success transplanting them. Just up to you. Winter squash goes back the same thing with the pumpkins. If you got plenty of seed and seed quantity is not an issue, direct seed them. If you're wanting to, get a better germination rate and you only got a few seed, transplant them. Swiss chard, we've done both of those. You can direct seed it thick on a bed and cut it like we do some of those greens like Savannah mustard, or you can transplant it out. Tomatoes. We always want to transplant tomatoes. And then watermelon. Some people, I would say there's probably a lot of people out there that do direct seed watermelon. I didn't put an asterisk beside this one because I just think transplanting watermelon is the way to go.
It's going to save you about 2 to 3 weeks on the maturity date.
And if you really want to get them watermelons in before the 4th of July, which is when everybody likes to eat watermelons.
Down where we're at.
Transplanting them is the way to go.
If you're up north and you got a limited growing season, transplant watermelons are going to give you a boom, pop, or you're going to be able to squeeze it in.
Okay, let's talk about direct seed, and this list is a lot shorter, and you'll notice we transplant probably twice as much stuff as we direct seed. And I've got a few asterisks here. So beans with direct seed, carrots with direct seed, corn, cucumbers. I've seen people transplant cucumbers, but we direct seed them. Our greens, we direct seed those. Peanuts, you want to direct seed those. The one with the asterisks here, English peas. I've seen this, those transplanted with success. I've never did it. We always just make us a furrow. And
yeah.
There's a guy on the Road by Road group showing, boy, you want to plant them thick.
Boy.
Get them in there. Field peas with direct seed, radishes, spinach, summer squash, and then lastly, turnips. I put an asterisk here because this is going to depend on what kind of turnip you're planting. If you're doing purple tops or your white globe turnips, direct seed them.
I have been transplanting this whole fall winter those all tops.
Now, the all tops, man. I would transplant those.
This worked well for me.
Okay. So those are kind of the list of what we do. And I want to go through this real quick, the advantages of why you might want to do one over the other. The advantages of transplanting, as we mentioned, you're going to get a head start on the growing season. Okay, this is great for areas that have really high disease or insect pressure. So here, you know, we can transplant pumpkins, get a head start on them, and get them grown off by the time things get nasty as far as disease pressure. It's also really great for areas with shorter growing seasons. Mm-hmm. If you live up north and still want to grow something like watermelon or okra, transplanting will let you do that. The second reason we like to transplant, you get a head start on the weed pressure, especially the case with slower germinating crops. You do get better germination, we find, when you transplant because you're growing in a very controlled environment.
Yep.
You can water more frequently. You control the conditions early in the life of the plant, which gives you a better shot at success. And the last thing, and this goes back to some of the more expensive varieties, transplanting is overall less expensive because you're not going to have to thin anything. Whereas if you direct seed, sometimes you would plant more seeds than you need. You'd go in and thin to the optimal spacing. With these more expensive hybrid varieties, transplanting is going to be the most economical option.
You know, in the big ag, some of these hybrid vegetable seeds have gotten so expensive, the only way they can do it anymore is through transplant.
Yeah, some of the stuff's a quarter, 50 cent a seed, which is just crazy. The advantages of direct seeding, obviously, it's going to be less time consuming. Transplanting, growing out transplants does take more time. So direct seeding is less time consuming. It really works good for crops that require close spacing. So if you put plants really close together, it's going to take you forever to transplant a spot. So things like corn, beans, carrots, radish, and greens, things that are grown pretty close together within a few inches of one another, direct seeding is the way to go. And crops that germinate easily, things that you don't have to baby to get them germinated, you know, direct seed and save you some time.
Microgreens come to mind on that.
So if you have any questions or there are any crops that we left out, put those in the comments below and let us know. And if you have different experiences than us, if there's some crops that we transplant you like to direct seed or vice versa, let us know so we can kind of know what everybody else out there
is. And when
doing.
I put my glasses on, what time is it?
That is question time.
Question time.
Question time. And so if we answer your question on the show, as always, send us an email to cusserve@hosstools.com with your address, and we'll be glad to send you a nice little prize.
Question one comes from Dominique Naomi. I hope I did that right.
Mm-hmm.
How do you rotate when you have a small 10 to 24 garden? I am only one person.
So we had a lot of people asking this. We talked about crop rotation last week. And a lot of people say, well, I've just got one little small garden plot. How do I rotate it? Well, it's a little more difficult than if you've got, you know, six or seven plots like we do. But you can still be mindful of where your rows are. You know, wherever that row is, you planted a squash last year, just don't plant another cucurbit there the following year. And on the small garden plots, you really need to be utilizing your cover crops. And cover cropping is easy to do, very manageable on a 10 by 24 plot. You know, make sure you grow a summer cover crop and squeeze in a fall or winter cover crop. And those will really help refresh the soil, even though you're not able to rotate it as broadly as if you had several plots. Question number two is from Lampkin Farm, and it says, Dear Mr. Watermelon King, certainly not the Cabbage King, but the Watermelon King, my husband wants us to grow some watermelons. We live in a lot in a subdivision in South Louisiana, 9B. Any advice, tips, anything would be appreciated. Thanks in advance.
Sure. Three things come to mind. Number one is give them plenty of room to the vines run out, give them plenty of room to grow. Watermelons just love to run and grow, so make sure you give them plenty of room. I've been guilty in the past of not giving them enough room, having to keep them trimmed back, and it's not a lot of fun. So give them plenty of room to grow. Number two is use some sort of drip irrigation. If you can't put a good drip irrigation system in as what we sell, you know, a sucker hose is better than nothing. But I would definitely do something, because these things is hard to get the water to them when they need it at the right time. So some type of drip irrigation, preferably a good one. Number three is you got to have pollinators for watermelons. So if you don't have a lot of natural pollinators, make plans to move some honeybees in there on it when they start blooming. And that will make sure that you got a good crop of watermelons and everything's pollinating in nice size and everything works well.
All good information.
All good information.
And I've got it planned for us to do a whole show on watermelons. And once we get...
That is kind of our thing. Or my thing is watermelon.
Yeah, once we get some of those other varieties added, the sangria and the jamboree, we'll do a whole show on watermelons and you can just share your infinite wisdom.
I can share it all. Okay, Hutch Milkerson wants to know, can you put the family and rotation scheme that we had on last week's show on the website, please?
So we have you may not have seen it, but we have a blog on the website. If you scroll down the bottom of the page, there's a little link that says Wheelho Blog. So every one of our videos gets turned into a blog, which is kind of a show notes section. It's also where our podcast is hosted. So if you can't watch the show, you can always go listen to the audio on iTunes or wherever you like to listen to your podcast. So it's not always, the blogs are not always posted immediately after the show. It could take a week or two, but we'll get that information up there in some kind of table so you can easily access and look at it later. Last question is from Val H, and she says, I have a 4,000, or Val could be a fella, I don't know. They say, I have a 4,000 square foot garden. I practice crop rotation and amend the soil every year. I try for a pH close to 6.8, get my soil tested every year. How do I handle the various crop pH preferences? Potatoes like a lower pH, others more neutral. Should every crop have to tolerate the same pH, or should I amend the area where I have the lower pH crops planted? Thanks. Now, this is an issue a lot of people ask.
Yeah, you know, we don't live in a perfect world. So sometimes we have to, you know, fudge a little bit on certain things. In a perfect world, you would have the right pH for the right crop you're growing in that time. But it's really hard to do that. Irish potatoes like a pH around 6.0, anywhere from 5.8 to 6.0. Let's just say an average of 6.0. And we know tomatoes and peppers and other things like about a 6.5 to 6.8. So there is a range there. In an ideal world, you would plant your potatoes on your new spot every year and work it into your rotation that way. If you don't have that, just do the best you can and don't get hung up on a lot of this small stuff. Just rotate it in, and I think you'll be fine. That's what I do. Because we just can't afford ourselves the opportunity to start a new spot every year sometimes. Sometimes we can. If we do that, use your potatoes on your first rotation crop there, and then add a little lime up your pH and work your other things in there. But if you don't have that and you got the same old garden, just work your normal rotation through.
Yeah, it's almost impossible. And a lot of people don't understand about pH. pH is pretty strongly buffered in that it takes a lot to move the pH. Little slight changes do not really affect the pH. But if you're going on a huge scale, you're growing 100 acres of potatoes, you could go in there and get the pH just right. But if you're growing on a small scale like most of us are, it's just going to be impossible to micromanage the pH.
Just don't get hung up on the details sometimes. They're important. Sometimes we just have to live with it and go on. We do not live in a perfect world.
If you just get your soil in that window between 6 and 6.5, I'd say, if you can keep it comfortably in that range,
you'll be fine.
You'll be fine and you'll be doing the best you can do.
Yep.
All right. So hope everyone enjoyed the show tonight. Lots of good information on transplanting, direct seeding. If you have any comments, questions, let us know below. We always appreciate everybody watching. And don't keep us a secret. And we will see you guys on next week's show, where hopefully we'll be talking about potatoes.
And look here, folks. It's that time of year where you got to get off that couch and get out there and start getting that garden prep. So just remember this right here. Every time you sit down there fixing to watch something with your big old bag of potato chips, you think to yourself, I need to get off his couch and get out there and get started. And that's what we want you to do, because spring is right around the corner.
Right around the corner, and it's better to be ahead than it's to be behind.
So get off the couch.
See you guys next time.